Ghost Wolf Radio calling. This is Ghost Wolf Radio calling. And this is side B of this cassette that I will be sending to Tom Metzger. You can reach Tom Metzger at tm_Metzger@yahoo.com. You can write him at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. You can call the Aryan Update line at 574-267-5036. But I guess they got other update lines in other cities, like one for Boston and Chicago and a couple other cities. I'm going to be reading today out of Partisan Warfare by Otto Heilbronn. Nice German name. I read part of this before in another show, so I thought I'd read up to where I left off reading. I haven't finished reading it, actually. Okay. It says, recruits, it should be noted, were not always volunteers. Frequently, a considerable part of the force consisted of part-timers who worked in their normal civilian occupation when not called up. And it also goes on to say, recruiting only communists, they drew the line somewhere. Reactionaries were excluded. You know, reactionaries, we definitely don't want nothing to do with them, because they could be for us one day and they could be against us the next day. So, but we don't have to worry about that, do we? Because we are individuals. We are single man armies. We are single man cells. And if you can just catch the vision of what I've been talking about on the last show, maybe the couple of shows before that, you know, we have a chance to really do something that has never been done before. To create a silent brotherhood, more silent than the Order. A silent brotherhood that would make the members of the Order proud. A order that will not be penetrated or infiltrated or spied upon. How can you when none of the members know each other? So catch the vision, please. Catch the vision and do what needs to be done. Okay, reactionaries were excluded, but otherwise accepted any support as long as they could keep control of the movement and indoctrinate its members. You know, you're indoctrinated. When you indoctrinate, you will indoctrinate anonymously. You will spread black propaganda, great propaganda. It doesn't even matter what kind of propaganda. You will leave propaganda in a way that can't be traced back to you. Spray paint is beautiful. What I like to do when I buy a can of spray paint, I take off the label of it, because the label's got the barcode on it. And if it, by some chance I lost it somehow, I don't want it accidentally winding up in the, you know, Zog's hands. So that's what I like to do. Okay. If the partisans can avoid detection and annihilation while their movement is being formed, their expectation of life is rather good. This was shown not only by practically all wartime and also successful post-war partisan movements, but by the defeated ones as well. The emergency in post-war Greece lasted 3 years, in Malaysia lasted 12 years, and in Kenya and Cyprus 4 years. The reason for this apparently remarkable endurance is not far to seek. Owing to the peculiarities of this kind of war, it takes a long time for anti-guerrillas to turn the tables. Anti-guerrilla superiority in heavy arms and equipment frequently does not count at all, because it cannot be brought to bear on partisans in their chosen theater of operations. Jungles, marshes, mountains, forests. Anti-guerrilla wars are largely won by other means, morale and communications. Colonel C.M. Woodhouse would elucidate their significance and their interdependence as follows. End quote. Morale and communications are ambivalent. cut both ways. There has never been a successful guerrilla war conducted in an area where the populace is hostile to the guerrillas. And conversely, it is virtually impossible to stamp out a guerrilla war in an area where the populace is to support the guerrillas. The art of defeating the guerrillas is therefore the art of turning the populace against them, as the Greeks successfully demonstrated in 1949. And here arrives the second important factor of communications. In an area of primitive communications, the anti-guerrilla force is hopelessly handicapped unless it can get the populace on its side. This is something, I mean, when I read stuff like this, I just get even more convinced that I think I'm on to something. Well, I'm not me, but maybe just the way I'm articulating it may be a little bit different than what you've heard before. We do not have the populace on our side, and that is not going to happen for the foreseeable future. We need to do what we can to bring collapse. We need to do what we can to start sawing through the legs of the table to bring the table down. Okay? Now, guerrilla groups can become detected. You know, you've got a nosy neighbor, you got someone peeking into your business, but if you're a lone guy and you're going out and you're doing stuff, and there's a lone guy maybe three counties over doing stuff, you know, they're going to think that, you know, this is a coordinated, you know, group thing. They're going to think that there's a structure, there's a hierarchy of leadership, maybe even a centralized leadership. But, you know, you guys don't have that. And how could you be penetrated? How could you be spied upon if you adhere to all the things we've been talking about? You know, nondescript, uncharacteristic clothing. You don't talk about race. And in fact, if anything, you talk, you know, anti-racist. But if you're going to take that stance, you better be doing some things. So, we are not going to have the population on our side. We are not going to distribute enough flyers to get them on our side. The white race, the sheepocracy that comprises the white race, you know, and a lot of them die due to collateral damage. You gotta just harden your heart to that, because if you want to make an omelet, you gotta break a few eggs, okay? And we have fucking white people, blonde hair, blue eyed white women, in lockstep with the destroyers of our race. You gotta just look at that and say, fuck that. You know, all we gotta do is just save a small percentage of us and the rest can go to hell. We can start over again with a very, you know, maybe we can save 2% of the white population in America and the rest can go to hell. I mean, you know, that's not a lot of people, but I mean, if that's the choice, then it needs to be done. We need to be born again hard. I mean, we need to really reinvent ourselves in a more ruthless manner. The pattern is always the same. Indoctrinate, subjugate the population. It is too familiar to require further description. Well, I say we indoctrinate by our actions. I believe it's better for them to fear us than for them to respect us. We see that play out in all kinds of ways in American society. Gangs and motorcycle gangs and criminal enterprises, nobody wants to cross them because they're ruthless. What does that tell you? That tells you that we need to become ruthless. If you want to maintain your honor, you want to be honorable, like the honor I talked about, like, you know, the honor Wellington showed Napoleon at the end of Waterloo, do that with another racialist, but you cannot do that with another white man in this society. There are just too many of them, too poisoned, and you don't have time to sort out the good ones from the bad ones. In the last resort, counter-propaganda and other measures help to shorten the war, and if only the anti-guerrillas are successful on the battlefield. Another factor which can considerably extend the lifespan of the guerrilla movement is the economic one. If the theater of war is a country which is underdeveloped or not well off, and if it is not assisted by richer allies, it can ill afford the financial expenditure of an anti-guerrilla war and may therefore have to restrict its war effort. It is indeed one of the avowed aims of revolutionary guerrillas to extend the war to the economic front and the means of economic warfare are manifold. In Kenya and Cyprus, a boycott of British goods was organized. In Malaya and Kenya, the insurgents devoured to secure the withdrawal of labor from plantations, mines, and farms, and local workers were intimidated. In Greece, the Parsons tried to create food shortages by raids on villages and removal of livestock. And generally, private parties or private property is destroyed. Public utilities, especially communications, are sabotaged, and public life is further disrupted by the murder of administration officials. Last but not least, defense expenditure is driven up. You know, this economic crisis, it gives us the window of opportunity. You know, that a lot of municipalities don't have a lot of money. I'm telling you, we are being given a golden opportunity. We already missed one golden opportunity, and that was the 1960s in the southern part of the United States. Most of the white people down there didn't want their schools infiltrated with fucking baboons. They didn't want it. And now look at the South now. Look at Birmingham. Look at Little Rock. Look at New Orleans. Look at these southern towns. Atlanta. Fucking, I mean, even the Mexican gangbangers are making a foothold in Atlanta. Atlanta used to be a white town. Okay, so if you want to save your race, you got to be ruthless. If you don't care about your race, if you just want to listen to these shows to get your ears tickled, well, you know, you're just going to watch your race go down the fucking drain then. Okay? And, I know I've said before I want to watch my language, but I'm just too frustrated at white people right now to really care about the sensibilities of people, you know, who have nitpicky issues, you know. I mean, I'll try to watch my language, but if I don't, well, tough shit. And I'm at the point right now, I mean, you know, I could give a damn if, you know, a lot of you guys wrote in the Metzger and said, you know what, get this fucking Frank Bauer off the air. He's starting to piss me off. You know, I hope I piss you off. If you haven't noticed my tone by now in these shows, I'm doing my damnedest to piss you guys off. I don't want you fucking comfortable. I'll do whatever it takes to light a fire under your ass. Our race is going to shit and we're not doing a goddamn thing about it. Going on, it says, at any rate, hear that siren? I guarantee it's for a fucking stick. At any rate, in this type of warfare, the guerrillas have all the advantages as long as they avoid alienating potential supporters. You can have potential supporters as an individual ghost wolf, but they're not going to know your racial views. I said that yesterday. It is easier and requires less manpower to strike at the objectives than to protect them. And the guerrillas are invulnerable in this type of warfare. They don't have an economy. We do have an economy. It's an underground economy. We thus find that guerrillas' chances of survival are rather good because their opponent is not necessarily superior to them on the battlefield, and he has added disadvantage in the conduct of psychological and economic warfare, which played the bigger part in guerrilla wars than in conventional war. Okay, I mean, we can be doing a lot of things to make the pocketbooks of our enemies hurt even more. Okay? You know, I hate when I outline something, but I don't... I outline the top of it, but I don't show where it stops. So I don't know where to stop reading here. I'll just have to play it by ear. Alright, going on. It says, then came the Japanese invasion. Not only did it give relief from Chinese nationalist attacks, but in taking up the fight against the Japanese, the communists could harass or harness the patriotism of those in regions under their control and draw on the support of many Chinese who had suffered grievously at Japanese hands. Well, that, you know, in Chiang Kai-shek's China, the nationalists and the Mao's communists, well, they had a common enemy, the Japanese, you know, the enemy of my enemy. So that's why they were able to work together there. They also can incorporate into their ranks nationalist army stragglers and small formations which had been cut off from their units. They only had to give their policies a temporary look, which they proceeded to do. One of the principles of the so-called political work of their forces was the establishment of unity between the army and the people, and this was now interpreted to mean that the people's property must be respected, the crops should be safeguarded against the enemy, especially during harvesting. Well, and there we go, respecting the people. But you really think white people deserve respect? White people in Knoxville who sat on their ass and didn't just fucking go... I mean, what would it take for five guys, five white men in Knoxville, to wait for the sun to go down, to go into other neighborhoods, to go into the, you know, just maybe patrol outside the Washington Ridge apartment complex, the complex that Shannon Christian and Christopher Newsom were abducted in, and just take it to some black ass. I mean, whether they were involved or not, it doesn't matter. Okay? We're too goddamn merciful. And there's another word for that. Maybe we're too goddamn pussy ass or something. Getting pissed off yet? Guerrilla warfare cannot survive for long and develop itself without a base, says Mao. I don't necessarily agree with that. Before the facilities for guerrilla bases provided by nature for us to exploit and the enemy's insufficiency in armed forces, the communist guerrillas would have been condemned to a roaming and raiding war. But no war of this type ever succeeded. Is that right? Well, I think one like that can succeed. You got individuals out there who are committed to the white race. You want to make the sacrifice, and they're going out and committing a raiding and roaming war. You know? In different localities. And when a ghost wolf is sitting in a bar and he hears a news report on some activity he did, he's not going to say, "Hey, Mac, can you turn up the TV? I want to hear that." He's going to act like he doesn't even care about it. And if he finds himself in a group of people who are talking about the act that he did the night before, he's going to talk bad about that ghost wolf or that individual. He's going to say, "That's our damn problem, man. Our society is filled with a bunch of fucking whack jobs. Hope they catch this guy and cut his balls off. But don't overdo it. And by all means, don't go to your coworkers and your family, "Hey, did you hear what happened last night?" And keep insistently talking about your activities, but not in a manner that you're bragging about it, but just constantly bringing it up in casual conversation. Don't do that. Because there are a number of serial killers that did the same thing, and that attracts the people's attention. That's a red flag to law enforcement. If by some chance you become a person of interest, law enforcement will talk to the people in your inner circle and say, "Yeah, he was really obsessed with that case, man. Every time, you know, it was on TV, a news report, he wanted to, you know, hear what they had to say. He was reading newspapers about it." When you do something and it goes down, act like you're not even interested in the story. And if your friends are, then maybe you can allow your curiosity peaked a little bit. "Hey, what are you guys talking about? Oh man, you didn't hear that shit that went down last night? No, what?" You know, play stupid. And then when they tell you what happened, you know, talk about the activity in a bad way. Okay, this is, I'm telling you, you know, I watch enough of these documentaries about serial killers, and a lot of them go down because they talk too much about the crime, not about their participation, but just talking about what went down. And, you know, they constantly read the newspaper about it and bringing the subject up to their friends. Don't do that shit. Play dumb, like you don't even care. And if your friends are interested, show a little bit of interest. But, you know, when you find the time, when you're with this group of people, change the subject to something else. Seem uninterested in that. You don't need to hear them talking about it to stroke your fucking ego. You know, monitor the news, see what's going on, but don't show any interest in it. To the partisans, the liberated areas were frequently a handicap. Their very existence offended against the classic guerrilla rule of surprise. They invited attack by the enemy and often made the partisans lose the initiative. Well, they're talking about the Germans here. Hold on, let me start over.
to the partisans, the liberated areas were frequently a handicap. Their very existence offended against the classic guerrilla rule of surprise. They invited attack by the enemy and often made the partisans lose the initiative. They restricted partisan elusiveness. And when the partisans had to give up liberated areas, part of the population left too, blocking escape routes and hampering mobility. The Yugoslav partisans overcame the handicaps by good leadership and sheer bravery. But their experience underlies the validity of Mao's dictum that base areas must be vast to allow partisans room to maneuver. In small countries like Belgium, Mao said, the possibility is very little or nil. If a country is not vast or large areas are not inaccessible, the strategic benefits of guerrilla bases are largely canceled out by the attendant tactical disadvantages. You know, if you guys got War to Flee, read chapter 8 about General Grivas in Greece. Or, I don't know if he did his thing in Cyprus, but he didn't have a whole lot of ground to maneuver. He kicked ass. All right. I got one line outlined here. I wonder why I only outlined one line. Even so, the revolutionaries were almost exclusively infantrymen. They had practically no air force, few tanks, no medium or heavy artillery, and their guerrilla experience stood them in good stead. Guerrilla discipline had been strict. They had learned marching in their guerrilla exploits, and guerrillas had known how to use what weapons they had. Whatever. I mean, it's a good idea, I said before, to get used to walking. Get your feet used to walking. You may need it someday. It has been repeatedly pointed out in reviews of the Chinese War, 1946-1949, that while the guerrillas and semi-regulars canceled or excelled, what the fuck, do I get dyslexia or something? Semi-regulars excelled in mobility, their opponents increasingly lost their offensive spirit and developed what had been called a pillbox psychology. These factors, it is held, greatly influenced the outcome of the war. Exactly the same observation had been made in regard to the Indochinese War. It therefore seems opportune to inquire whether guerrilla tactics in both wars forced the opponents into a state of immobility and static defense. And if so, how was this achieved? The national soldiers were badly fed and badly paid, and with the Japanese invader gone, they hardly knew what they were fighting for. I guess they're talking about the nationalists. Okay. See, I guess one of the prerequisites of being a ghost wolf, you guys out there, you got to be fanatics. Got to think about it. When you walk out your door and you see racial destruction everywhere. If you're like me, you see it everywhere. It's always on your mind. That's a fanatic. There's nothing wrong with that. TV, Hollywood, everyone else, they say bad things about the fanatic. Oh, it's not good to be a fanatic. No, it is good to be a fanatic. You just got to be a fanatic for the right reasons and for the right things. Freedom of action is the very life of an army, and once this freedom is lost, an army faces defeat and annihilation. We can say that the exterior line quick decision attacks, which we have proposed, as well as flexibility in planning and carrying out such attacks, tend to gain the initiative in order to force the enemy into a passive position. Initiative or passivity is inseparable from superiority or inferiority in fighting strength. That wasn't worth reading. Passivity, Mao concludes, is always disadvantageous, and one must try to get out of it by all means. The way to achieve this militarily is resolutely to launch exterior line quick decision attacks and to start guerrilla warfare in the enemy's rear to secure partial yet overwhelming superiority and initiative over the enemy in numerous campaigns of mobile and guerrilla warfare. Okay, if you lose the initiative, pick up and move someplace else. Start up again. But you guys as lone wolves, yeah, I still like that term, lone wolf. You guys as lone wolves, I mean, you You don't have to worry about none of this. I mean, you're, you know, your initiative is all over the place. You do something here. Next night you do something 20 miles away. Then maybe, you know, maybe 4 days later you're doing it in two states over. And that's just you. What if there's five other guys in other part of the country doing the same thing? Five guys can get this fucking country in an uproar. Five guys. You got a guy in the Southwest, a guy in the Northwest, a guy in the North Mid-Atlantic or North Plains in the Midwest, like Nebraska or whatever. I mean, five guys in this country spread out could just have this country in fucking chaos. Easily. And I know it's a science fiction book, but Wasp and James Mowry, he did all that shit, all the chaos, he called, he's one guy. He messed with their economy by, you know, using counterfeit money to pay for things. He was constantly putting out propaganda. And the secret police were just convinced that this was a well-organized organization. I mean, it was one guy. You guys got to look at that kind of stuff. And I talked briefly about the 100th Monkey last night on the flip side of this tape. And I talked about it a couple months before, but I guess these Japanese zoologists were going to various islands off the coast of Japan, and you know, they were studying these monkeys, their behavior, and all that other stuff. And they were feeding them sweet potatoes. They were throwing these sweet potatoes on the beach, but the monkeys liked the sweet potatoes, but they didn't like the sand. You know, they didn't like that grit in their mouth. Finally, one monkey had the wherewithal to, you know, kind of rinse it off in the stream. Then one, then two did it. And they noticed that the ones that did it the most were the young, because the old were set in their ways. Maybe you should critique your propaganda to the young. Maybe you should make threats on bathroom stalls to the white youth. And maybe you need to word it in a way where you say, no matter how much you try to be my friend, you're a dead motherfucker, white boy, and shit like that, you know? I mean, we need to play on the white race's two most base emotions, fear and anger. I'm trying to appeal to their intellect no more. It's been thoroughly dumbed down over 60 years of Jewish television. Okay. There now came the first reports that many National soldiers had deserted and that morale among the troops was generally low. They were also said to be developing a defensive mentality. There were a number of reasons for this. Mao's forces were mostly locally raised and were defending their homes, while the Nationalists, coming from all parts of China, fought on almost alien soil. Mao's troops seemed to have paid for what they received from the population. Okay. You know, if they took some from the population, they paid them. I don't know. I'm still out to lunch about whether the white race deserves that kind of respect. You know? TV has thoroughly saturated their minds that anyone who believes in the survival of the white race is a subhuman. We're just like one step above a pedophile. So do they deserve that kind of respect? We take something, we pay for it, we leave their house, we make sure the screen door's closed. I'm more inclined to say, fuck that. They don't deserve that. Maybe I'm just overly pissed off. The extensive development of our guerrilla warfare in his rear, says Mao, of his former Japanese enemy, has driven his garrisons in the occupied territories into a completely passive position. When individuals, just five of you out there, start doing it, the Praetorian alphabet soup organizations whose sole purpose is not to defend the American country, the American citizen, but to run interference for the American Caesars, the American elite, you know, the realm of law enforcement in this country, they're not going to be in passive positions. All we have to do is start running them up, just five of you. I'm not asking for a whole lot. I'm not begging for a whole lot. Five individuals? We can't get five guys out of the fucking radio club spread throughout the United States that's willing to do some things? You know, play these fucking Ghost Wolf fucking shows and just memorize this shit. Like I said last night, I wasn't born with this. I developed this way of thinking over time, and I came out of the shadows and stopped what I was doing to share this stuff with you guys because I wanted to multiply my mindset. I believe I'm onto something. I believe that the years that I've been doing shit, I'm not going to specify what I'm doing. You know, you could be sitting there in the comfort of your own living room saying, man, you didn't do shit. You may be right, but you'll never fucking know, will you? But the soundness and the validity of my tactics speaks for itself. Can they be improved upon? Absolutely. Anyone's can. Five guys. Five hardcore, in-shape men. And if you're not in shape, get in shape. But don't wait until you get in shape before you start acting. The least you can do is start doing propaganda. We can't even get you guys to put resist.com on a fucking bathroom stall. I mean, goddamn. Five guys can have this country in an uproar. Five guys can get blacks and whites not trusting each other. Five guys can get blacks and whites almost at each other's throats. Five guys. Five guys can get law enforcement so spread out in this country trying to put their finger in this dike and that dike and, you know, five guys can do it. We don't need a fucking army. You just got to see yourself and what your role is. You are poison in the veins of this sick society. I don't know what chemical it is they inject prisoners with when they give them a lethal injection, but that's what you are. You know, and an interesting phenomenon is that during the act of destruction of a corrupt and decayed civilization, the seeds of construction have already been planted. Don't worry about who's going to build what after you. It will be built. You just got to win. And you win by staying anonymous. You win by shutting your mouth about race. You win by actually pretending to be a lover of Obama or anything else. I fear that the people who are on the radio club have maybe spent too much time in the organizations and everyone knows them too well. Well, you know what? You cover up your tats and you go a couple states over to do what you got to do. You don't do chicken shit stuff either. You do something that makes a fucking impact. War is a contest of strength, but the original state of strength changes in the course of war. Here are the efforts one makes to score more victories and commit fewer errors are the decisive factor. While we strive for superiority and initiative, the enemy strives for them too. Thus, war is in truth a contest in ability between the commanders of opposing armies in their struggle for superiority and initiative. We do not have superiority, but we have initiative. Now, who will seize the initiative? If you're standing in front of a guy and you throw a punch at him, 9 times out of 10, you're gonna hit with that punch because he has to react to what your action is. He has to react to your initiative. And when you do seek the initiative, you never set a pattern. I don't need to elaborate on that. You're smart enough to know what that means. In the 1950s, the Viet Minh had begun this process of infiltration, and in 4 years, they had built up their strength until their opponent was forced into passivity and withdrawal. As a military operation, it had brilliantly succeeded. General Giap, the Viet Minh commander in charge, had shown himself a truly outstanding disciple of Mao. Why the fuck did I outline that? Was it to it? Maybe a paragraph above it. By combined operations of regulars and guerrillas, they had succeeded in completely immobilizing the Union forces in their position. Some of the southern delta regions had been infiltrated to such an extent that the entire area had become unattainable to the French Union forces. Well, initiative. Initiative, the I word. It is therefore obvious that even if an opponent is weaker, guerrillas can force him into passivity only if he disperses his forces over too wide an area.
Shit, five guys over the continental United States? That could do a lot. How about three guys in England? That could do a lot. 100th monkey. One monkey cleans its sweet potato off in the stream, then two, then three. You know? What if three guys start in England, then it spurs on people in America to do it. And then Canada, and then Germany, and then all of a sudden it's a worldwide revolution amongst the white diaspora. First you have to unplug yourself from the lies of society, and they're everywhere. TV, school, government. How much of this did I read? Wider. Deprives himself of the means of attack and thereby loses the will. Fuck that, let me start over again. It is therefore obvious that even if an opponent is weaker, guerrillas can force him into passivity only if he disperses his forces over too wide an area, deprives himself of the means of attack, and thereby loses the will. Since he cannot then protect the population, he is almost bound to lose the war. We don't need to protect the population. All you need to do is protect yourself. And do you want the shit to hit the fan when the white race is 30% of the population? I think we have a better chance of winning if it happens while we're 65%. Yeah, we're gonna get our eye blackened. But look on the bright side, there'd be a lot of weak whites we won't have to execute. You know, there'll be a lot of nigger loving whites who'll be victims of black violence. You know. Just needs to happen. Apart from this, guerrilla actions are based on surprise, quick decision, and mobility in attack and dispersal. And these tactics do not allow for passivity. Equally, Mao's famous 10 principles for the conduct of guerrilla warfare, expounded in his speech to the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party of December 25th, 1947, are so designed as to keep the guerrillas in an almost constant state of movement. Do not let the enemy have breathing space. Train to fight successive engagements within a short period. Strike first at scattered and isolated enemies. You know, economy of force? Take your 20 guys against five of his. In fact, his emphasis, and who's the founder of economy of force? Erwin Rommel, white man, Aryan, tactical genius. Take first the small towns, and take first weakly defended cities, and on the need to destroy the enemy while he is moving. Of necessity, keeps the guerrillas on the move themselves. We're not going to take small towns. I say do nothing in a town that is under 20,000 people. But if it borders another town of 20,000 people, fine. You can do what you want. I'm talking about a town that has 20,000 people, and that town is surrounded by farmland. And the nearest town of any considerable size is like 5 miles away. Don't do nothing in a town like that. Like, for example, we got suburbs around Chicago, like north suburbs and like Prospect Heights. I don't think Prospect Heights, Illinois, has got that many people. Maybe a little bit more than 20,000, but not that many. But Prospect Heights is surrounded by Mount Prospect, it's surrounded by Arlington Heights, I believe the Splains. So you have a town, it may have a small population, but it's surrounded by other towns. Hey, go to work. You'll be fine. You drive away from what you did, you go down the street, you cross one intersection, you're in the next town. It's like that. I'm saying stay out of small towns that are surrounded by rural area, because you will stand out. A small town surrounded by other small towns that are suburbs of a big city, you won't stand out. The first 2 or 3 years of the emergency in Malaya, the British attempted to penetrate the jungle in battalion strength, but the guerrillas always had early warning of their approach, and the missions accomplished little. The initiative always rested with the guerrillas, who managed to inflict considerable damage. If therefore became clear that the British required considerably more knowledge of the ways of guerrillas before they could hope to beat them. And for this purpose, General Briggs set up a ferret force, I guess to ferret out the guerrillas. General Briggs set up a ferret force of British, Malayan, Gurkhas, and Chinese troops. This force lived in a jungle for months in order to carry out patrols and obtain intelligence on
the MRLA, which is the guerrilla group. After its return, members of the force were assigned to various units as information and intelligence officers so that these units could benefit from their experience. From then on, the British sent only squads to platoons into the jungle. They copied the techniques of the guerrillas. They became adept at avoiding detection and highly skilled at ambushing and cutting supply lines. Like guerrillas, they lived on the land and frequently changed their locations. You know, we're not going to be living in the jungle. If you got a safe house out in the woods like what Ted Kaczynski had, hey, more power to you. I just wouldn't, if they're on to you and they find out about it, they can shoot you like a dog out there and no one will see it. So, you got to weigh the risk. How much time do I have? Got to check the fucking time. Can't see through this goddamn glass. Thanks, Metzger! No, really, thanks. It's a great little machine here. Hand in hand with these new tactics went the food denial measures, the removal of the jungle fringe squatters who had supplied the guerrillas with food, their resettlement in areas where they could be protected against guerrilla raids and enjoy for the first time electric light, water, good roads, and security of land tenure, and the formation of the Aborigine Fighting Regiment, which was already been mentioned in Chapter 2. These measures in combination had a double effect. They won over a large part of the population to the British side and then led to the extension of the guerrilla supply lines. Since these could now be ambushed, the guerrillas had less and less contact with the population and also had to grow their own food and jungle clearings. These clearings provide a good target for the ARF, Royal Air Force, and the guerrillas were gradually driven deeper and deeper into the jungle. They had become isolated. We're starting out isolated. But our strength is the fact that we're by ourselves. And we don't draw attention to ourselves by talking race. I can't harp on this enough. This tactic, this, what I've been talking about, this brotherhood, this silent order that is impenetrable by any of the Praetorian law enforcement agencies, it's never been tried. We just need five guys to start it off. Five guys do it. The Yacht Commandos were first formed in 1942, as mentioned earlier in this chapter. These were the German Wehrmacht. And they were of a company platoon strength, and their purpose was to make possible attacks on bands, even when other small forces were available. The leading idea behind their battle technique was unobtrusively to get as near to the band as possible by imitating their fighting technique and assimilating themselves to local conditions. They then had to annihilate bands by surprise action. The Yacht Commandos were, in fact, shock troops. And in all these respects, the Malayan anti-guerrillas resembled them. The mission of the Yacht Commandos, the German commandos, were to see to it that the bands never got a rest. They had to interfere with the building up of the bands and cut their supply lines. They had to provide a band-free area coping from Mao. The Germans declared fortified camps unsuitable targets for the German commandos' activities and also were strongly superior forces. You know, most of the time, guerrilla activities are going to succeed because guerrillas decide when and where to strike. They disperse quickly. And there are a few examples of anti-guerrilla activities succeeding. The three that stand out are in communist Greece, the Hucks in the Philippines, and then this group in Malaysia. And the Germans had some success with the Russian partisans and some success in Yugoslavia. But how can they penetrate what we got going when we don't even know each other? And we're not talking about race. How can they penetrate that? They can't. How can they cut our supply? We don't have supply lines. We don't have base camps. We're by ourselves. We're just a few men who got enough balls to get the thing going. The German commandos fight in the following manner. It marches mostly by night and moves into a hidden camp in the daytime. Very smart. March and rest must be protected.
Reconnaissance begins when the battle area has been reached. From the footprints of the band's activities are ascertained.
Typical smart German. Looking at footprints and deciding, you know, kind of like reading their behavior. In order to avoid treachery, no contact must be made with the population. Okay, so these are these are counterinsurgency groups using guerrilla tactics. Did you hear this? They avoid all contact with the population. Again and again, the use of stationary reconnaissance troops has been found valuable for the German commandos. They observe the routes of approach and paths of the bands in place favorable for attack. Good camouflage, close liaison, and especially patience were the prerequisites of success. In order to maintain the element of surprise, the German commando does not transmit current reports. It means he stays off the radio. His radio traffic is not intercepted or spied on. However, especially important reconnaissance results which call for immediate attack by stronger forces will be transmitted. Well, a lot of people don't know it, but the French Foreign Legion hired a lot of ex-German Wehrmacht guys in 45 and 46 at the end of the war and sent these Germans to Vietnam. And I read somewhere, you can find on the internet, German soldiers in the French Revolution or the French Foreign Legion in Vietnam in like the early 50s. They were kicking ass because the Germans had a lot of experience fighting communists. In Russia, the Germans had resorted to another device. Pseudo-gangs or counterbands composed of members of the German security police and the security service, police troops, and reliable natives. They masqueraded as bands, and their purpose was to check on the morale of the population and make contact with the bands, you know, with the guerrilla groups. In Palestine, some pseudo-gangs worked on the British side during the post-war troubles, but their potentialities were fully realized only in Kenya, and there with outstanding effect. I talked about this yesterday. That's one of the downfalls of having a guerrilla group. You can meet up with another guerrilla organization, and it may be hired on by the system to portray a group of ghost wolves. They earn your trust, and all of a sudden you're fucking lying dead in the woods somewhere because they shot you in the back. But how can they do that if you're an individual? You guys on the radio club list, you guys aren't out meeting each other. How could they do that? How could they meet up with us? It's not like we're like single-celled resistance elements, one-man armies going around society wearing our ideology on our sleeve. How would they know us from anyone else on the street? I mean, we need to make more use of swimming the sea of the people than Mao ever thought. In fact, it really should be our saying. Mao didn't use it to the fullest of its capabilities. We will. With individuals swimming in the sea of the people, keeping their mouth shut about what they really think, not wearing distinctive clothing like screwdriver t-shirts or a fucking swastika t-shirt, and just blending in. And you're just doing what you need to do. You don't got to check in with no one. You do what needs to be done. I'm telling you, five guys can get this thing going. Five guys can bring chaos to this country in a week. But do you guys see the vision that I see? It was young British officer Major Frank Kitson, who was assigned to intelligence out there, found that he had no intelligence to pass on and, unaware of precedents, thought of using pseudo-gangs, which he then proceeded to form. He introduced a startling new feature. No longer were they made up of his own nationals, with a few natives added to act as guides and screens, but they were gangs of captured ex-terrorists with only one or two Europeans as commanders. By imitating the enemy in appearance and behavior, these gangs could approach the enemy without arousing suspicion and fight at close range. They could obtain information and take immediate action. When this idea proved successful in one or two districts where it had first been tried out, pseudo-gangs were formed and trained centrally for use anywhere. And at this point, Ian Henderson, a British police officer with unrivaled knowledge of the Mau Mau ways, took over. As he put it, our technique of penetrating and living with other Mau Mau gangs proved immensely successful time after time,
our collaborators contacted gangs and merged with them without difficulties. The pseudos ate and slept together with the real gangsters, and then at night tied them up or kept them covered and led them into captivity. In this way, 22 terrorists were accounted for each week. Most astonishing of all, the Mau Mau in the forest never had the remotest idea what was going on. But it was not very long before the stage it was reached when more than half the Mau Mau gangs on the Aberderies or whatever were actively working for us against their own leaders. Without resort to bribery and only by his understanding of Mau Mau mentality, Mr. Henderson had converted many of a captured bandit to his own use. What the Germans had half-heartedly tried in Yugoslavia, Greece, and Russia, turning bands against bands, was perfected in Kenya to a fine art. It culminated in a successful hunt of the leader, Kimathi, I guess his name is. Interesting. Very, very interesting. The Germans had achieved the same outstanding result in Russia if their political leaders had not bungled matters. That the experiment could succeed in Kenya was due to the terroristic traits in the Mau Mau makeup. 4 hours or even weeks, says Mr. Henderson, a hardened supporter of the Mau Mau will lean one way with utmost stubbornness, resisting every argument. Then suddenly, some minute factor produces a fantastic change and the victim leans the other way, often with equal stubbornness. I think that's attributed more towards racial characteristics than anything else. The Mau Mau being black, we're able to do that. You know, because they don't have the mental cognitive ability of the white man. I'm trying to get a look at this fucking tape in here to see how much time I got left. I think we need to pop this thing out, maybe. All right. See what else I can find in here. Like I said, I'm not even done with this book yet. All right. Talking about encirclement, I guess. Furthermore, it is clear that developments in aerial photography now make it possible to survey the battle area before the attack by means of reconnaissance aircraft, which flying at a great height no longer warn the band as hitherto of an impending action against them. Telling you, satellite photos, they're awesome. Need to use them. Partisan intelligence, for their own purposes, has two objectives: to find out enemy intentions against them and provide information. Well, as an individual, you don't need to do that because you, I guarantee, will fly under the radar for their own operations. They must also check the flow of information that reaches the enemy. And they do this by killing enemy informers, by terror methods designed to frighten the population away from the enemy, and by spreading misleading information about themselves. Can't stress enough, fear works. Fear works. We've been trying to, you know, I there flyers been passed around about Shannon Christian and Christopher Newsom. There have been flyers passed around about Reginald Carr and Jonathan Carr, two shit-skinned, filthy, stinking, greasy fucking niggers who killed those white kids in Wichita, December 14th in 2000. I mean, we got all these flyers going out there. They have not appealed to white people's anger. You know, I mean, in Wichita, I mean, when the trial took place, you know, there were people with a noose hanging outside their lawn. Big fucking deal. What kind of reminds me? I live in an area that's mostly shit-skinned Mexican. And I notice that the blocks that I walk down, I know where most of the white people live because they like to fly the American flag. And I'm telling you, I know I'm right with what I'm about to say. White people think that by flying the American flag, their attitude is like, I mean, if you were to step inside their mind, it's like they're saying, I'll show these Mexicans, I'm going to fly the American flag and make them feel uncomfortable. They don't give a fuck about that. You want to make them feel uncomfortable? Burn their fucking house down. You want to make them feel uncomfortable? Ambush a couple of them in a fucking Walmart parking lot. And the word will get around. We use the most pussy-ass methods to try and get things started. Literature has done us no good. Our race is, I mean, Don't even say, well, we've attracted more members. Well, yeah, more members of membership groups, and now these people who could have been great, you know, anonymous ghost wolves are now known by the system. Thanks a lot. We do all these pussy-ass methods, but we don't have the balls to do what needs to be done. What happened to us? You know, fucking 80 years ago is nothing for us to take a nigger's life for him raping some white woman. What happened to us? Did TV really have that much of an impact on us? Think about it. With the church? Another observation I noticed. There was a church down in Maryville, Illinois the other day. Some guy who, I guess he had a mental disorder or whatever, walked in the church and shot the preacher to death. You guys probably seen it on the local news there. Or not the local news, but the world news. And every time something like that happens, every time they interview a white witness, I hear this commonality of words. And it sounds something like this. When it was happening, I just couldn't believe it. It was just surreal. I just couldn't believe it was happening. It's like I was in a movie. It's like I was outside myself. You know who I never hear talk like that? Black witnesses to some kind of a violence. I never, never in my fucking miserable life have I ever heard a black man or woman on TV saying, well, when I saw the gunman and he shot him, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. I was like outside myself. It was just so surreal. I just couldn't believe it was happening. I've never heard a black person say that. White people are so fucking out of touch with what is real in this world. Maybe that's why we make up most of Christian ranks, because we want to believe in a fucking Ariel Sharon in the sky. We are sorry. We are fucking pitiful. And I am just asking a handful of whites not to be pitiful no more. How much information do you need? How many books? How many more books do you need to read? How many news stories in the 10 o'clock news do you have to hear? How much more taxes do you have to pay? How many more jobs do you got to lose to Mexicans and lose overseas? How many more churches are going to be built where there was a nice forest? How many more shopping malls? How many more commercials are you going to see on TV with the racially unclassifiable, with black men with lighter skinned black women? Come on, you know what that's about. Come on, that don't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. They want to inculcate into white minds that when they see a black man, it's just natural that he's with a lighter-skinned woman, even a white woman. And you sissy-ass white men who are attracted to these, I don't understand this. I mean, I love big white women. I just do. I love 6'3", 6'4", thick-legged, big round ass, big titty white women. I love big white women. And you fucking white guys who go for these little skinny ass fucking chink bitches. What the fuck is the matter with you? What, do you want to throw a little girl around in bed so you can feel like a real man? Is that it? We are so fucking pathetic. And I'm only asking just a microscopic section of white society. Microscopic. Just a handful. To say enough is enough. Enough with the race mixing. Enough with the political treason. Enough with America being led by political whores. There, we have no friends nowhere. Ron Paul is not your friend. The chairman of the Council of Conservative Citizens is not your friend. He is not your ally. He is not to be trusted with anything. Definitely Harold Covington. You know, maybe even members of the National Alliance.
You know how I got on the radar, the FBI? I was in the Alliance. I wasn't talking radical like I did now. I may have said some things in private conversations with one